You've been investigating the privatization of Iraq and the contracting scandals. What kind of economic models does it look like the Bush administration is about to impose on the country it's occupying?
Well, it's really interesting because they did impose it. What Paul Bremer achieved in 6 months usually takes several decades in Latin America. He was a kind of a one-man IMF. He blew in there, laid off hundreds of thousands of people, declared Iraq open for business while the phone lines were still out and the electricity was still out. The market was flooded with imports. He eliminated tariffs. Local industry was decimated, making room for American products to be sold without any competition. And then in September, he passed a series of orders, Order 37, Order 39, and Order 40 are the most significant ones, which were, this is why I call him a one-man IMF, it was a structural adjustment on steroids program, where he radically restructured the economy, announced that contrary to Iraq's constitution, which was quite protectionist of Iraqi industry and had all kinds of regulations against foreign ownership of the economy, announced that there would be 100% foreign ownership allowed in every industry except natural resources, including oil. He broke open the banking sector to 100% foreign ownership as well. He introduced a 15% flat tax, so people who are at the highest taxation level, who were being taxed at a level of 40%, were suddenly paying 15%. Announced that most of Iraq's 200 state-owned firms would be privatized. So we're talking about an incredibly radical sort of shock therapy, IMF-style adjustment done in a matter of 6 months. What's interesting about what's happening now, Doug, is that actually this model, which the business world was extremely excited about, the economists called the rules a capitalist dream. And of course, this is, you know, Donald Rumsfeld bragged that these were among the most liberal investment rules in the free world. All of this has kind of come crashing down on their heads because it was an act of tremendous hubris, and it turns out it was completely illegal because Iraq is actually not part of the free world. It is an occupied country, and occupied countries are governed by international laws. The Hague regulations and the Geneva conventions that say very explicitly that an occupying power can only change the rules of the laws of a country if they are absolutely forced to do so. And so they can do so for reasons of security, but they can't just do it on a whim. And, of course, that's what Bremer has done. So what's actually stung him is the cautiousness of investors, because international lawyers, I'm not talking about lefties here, I'm talking about international lawyers that work for giant trade law firms that specialize in brokering privatizations, turned around and said to their clients, don't go there, because a new Iraqi government could come in, the situation is extremely volatile, and they could reverse the privatizations, and you would have absolutely no recourse. So the insurance companies took a look at this and said, no, we're not insuring you. None of the big insurance companies would offer political risk insurance, expropriation insurance for Iraq. So what's happened actually is that, you know, we hear about the Bechtels and the Halliburtons, but these are entirely subsidized sort of corporate welfare projects. They have their own insurance. They're sort of in a category of their own. But the major sort of direct foreign investment actually hasn't been happening, even though Bremer has created this sort of dreamscape for foreign investors, because it's simply too risky.
Well, I can imagine oil companies certainly wanting to get a piece of the action, but there is no domestic economy to speak of in Iraq.
Yeah.
Now, the country is a wreck. What foreign investor in his or her right mind would go in there in the first place, regardless of the legal conditions?
There are real logistical issues, including the absence of commercial flights. There are ways of flying in, but it is difficult. And I went to this one of these trade shows. They have them every few weeks now. You know, how to get a piece of the action in Iraq. It was called Rebuilding Iraq 2. It was in Washington, D.C. And there were about 400 companies that were there. And, you know, there were all these war stories. All the investors, you know, everybody would start their presentation by telling some story about their plane having to fly corkscrews, you know, to land in Baghdad. And, you know, you just watch the delegates become more and more, you know, pale-faced and grim. You know, and the first of these meetings were described as a kind of a euphoric gold rush. This was the new dot-com. It was kind of death-com, right? I mean, just go make money off of misery in Iraq. And now it's really dawning on the investment community that there are extraordinary risks. Obviously, there's security risks. There was a guy who stood up at this conference, an ex-CIA agent who now is a private security firm, you know, who bellowed at the crowd, "Soft targets are us." And, of course, private contractors are being targeted. But obviously people are going in, Doug. But the what's really happening is I think that the period we're in now is, as I said, it's a period of corporate welfare. I think that the privatization, nobody wants to buy Iraq's assets when they are being upgraded for free on the public purse, right? The U.S. taxpayers at the moment are paying to bring the telephone system, the roads, up to a standard after which they will be sold. But like all privatization projects, they're subsidized by the state. The state does the heavy work of the upgrades and also the layoffs, and then they're sold once that work has been done.
I was shocked to read in the Wall Street Journal a couple of weeks ago that Bremer was saying that they're not going to privatize the oil industry. They're going to leave that in state hands. What's yes. going on there?
Well, I mean, for starters, Bremer had announced that I think it was 175 of the state firms were going to be privatized. You know, he's had to backpedal on this, and they are now talking about leasing with an option to buy because of the violations of international law that I referred to, and the fact that it is just simply unclear at best that these assets are America's to sell. There is a dispute. I would argue that it actually, there's no dispute. It's very clear that Iraq is not America's to sell. But even people who are trying to broker these privatizations admit that there is a dispute, and which is why they are leasing instead of buying at the moment. In terms of oil, I think a lot of it. I think it's two major factors. The first is what I was saying that the oil industry is in much, much, much worse shape than the White House convinced itself of ahead of time. I'm not saying believe, because there's all kinds of evidence that they actually had the intelligence but disregarded it and wildly overestimated their ability to get the oil industry up and running quickly. So I think that in terms of the very expensive upgrading that's going to happen, what the oil multinationals are going to do is wait for this to be done on the public dime, and then they'll come in and buy. The other issue, of course, is very systematic sabotage going on by the Iraqi resistance, by Iraqi resistance forces. So that's one reason. And then the other reason is just frankly, I think they are realizing that they have more than a resistance. They have a country on the verge of civil war. There is nothing more political than oil in Iraq. And if they were to announce that they were going ahead with their previously announced plans to privatize the oil, it would fuel the resistance. I mean, they're finally realizing that they have fueled this resistance actively in many ways. You know, for starters, by laying off 400,000 soldiers armed. And all the layoffs are now openly being discussed as recruits for the resistance. So I think that they're trying to, very late in the game, think about not fanning the fuels of the resistance, and oil privatization would just be incredibly explosive.
How should we think about this resistance? A lot of them are certainly leftovers from the Saddam regime and rather repulsive formation that was. Certainly, we're no fans of the American occupation. What is to be done in Iraq right now, and is there any side that we can take?
Well, I mean, I don't think it's terribly useful to think about, Tariq Ali wrote that there's an estimated 40 factions. So to think about, taking armchair sides between them, I think is rather silly. I would say, if you read the kind of sectarian Marxist-Leninist publications now, the entire Iraqi resistance is being celebrated as, the uprising of the working class. And obviously the truth is something much, much more subtle. I think that as far as international solidarity, international support goes, I think that the position should be very clear that the occupation is illegal and illegitimate, and that we should be supporting the Iraqi resistance that we're seeing in street demonstrations calling for direct elections. I mean, there were 100,000 people on Monday in the streets of Baghdad chanting, "No, no selection, yes, yes, elections." Arundhati Roy at the World Social Forum in Mumbai, India last week called on the forces assembled to become the global resistance to the occupation of Iraq. So, rather than having sort of interesting battles about, which faction you're supporting, I think it's, anyone whose government is involved, as yours is, in the occupation, I think that there's very strategic things that should be done. Arundhati Roy suggested choosing two companies that are making enormous profits off the war, whether Bechtel, Halliburton, Boeing, and engaging in mass civil disobedience. And I think from a Canadian perspective, because I'm Canadian, Bush just announced in Monterey that Canada will now be allowed to bid on the next round of contracts. From my perspective, I don't think any Canadian company should be taking these tainted contracts, and I think it's extraordinarily unseemly for governments that opposed the war on principled grounds to now be groveling for these contracts. I think the other message that should be very clear is that the election process that the U.S. is calling for, this so-called transition to democracy that Bush talked about in his State of the Union address, is a gross violation of democracy. What's being called for on the streets of Baghdad is direct elections. The U.S. is saying that they can't have direct elections by the deadline. The deadline is entirely artificial, created by the U.S. If they can't have the elections by the deadline, they should change the deadline. Also, it's not clear that they can't, but that's another debate. They've created this interim stage of a transitional government, which is being chosen through the Coalition Provisional Authority is selecting regional committees. They're handpicking them, in other words, who will then create these caucuses. So it's kind of an appointees government that will then be in power for up to 17 months, and that's how they're going to try to get their economic program ratified and made legal. It's very clear. They can't have direct elections in Iraq because the people of Iraq have made it very clear with their anger at the occupation that they would likely kick out the U.S. forces and reverse all of Bremer's economic reforms. So they have to create this kind of fake puppet government in between, which will then ratify the laws. So I think that in terms of an international pressure role, it should be to demand that there not be that interim stage, to support those calls in Iraq, to say, this deadline is completely artificial, and to also say to the UN, do not be a scrutineer for this sham, which is what, an election scrutineer for, a violation of every democratic principle in the book. I think it's very important that the UN not go in right now.
Of course, we don't have direct elections for president of the United States, so we can start with that democratic procedure here.
Right.
Along the lines of what Roy said, a year ago we had a very populist and visible anti-war movement that, to the naked eye, looks like it's kind of melted away.
Mm-hmm.
Is it possible to reconstitute it as some kind of anti-occupation movement, or is that just too complicated and abstract to organize masses of people around?
You know, I don't think it is. And I think that the reason for that, I think the anti-war movement has to become a pro-democracy movement. And I think it's quite remarkable and moving and courageous that we are seeing this nascent pro-democracy movement in Iraq standing up to the U.S. You know, the U.S. media tries to blur it all together as, you know, violent terrorists. Anybody who resists is, is sinister, of course. I think that the combination of this very fast-growing movement, I mean, this is quite mind-boggling, 100,000 people on the streets, 30,000 people, a few days earlier, to think about how we, who were part of the anti-war movement, can support that, because that's a positive demand. I think people really can get excited about that. And what's exciting about it, and I think makes it strategically doable, is that, you know, in the absence of finding weapons of mass destruction, in the absence of a September 11th link, saying that the war was about democracy is the only thing Bush has left, right? So it really is an opportunity to kind of flip his own rhetoric on him. Now, obviously, this war was not about democracy from the U.S., from the White House's perspective, or there wouldn't be people on the streets chanting, no, no, USA, yes, yes, elections. I mean, they are actively standing in the way of democracy in Iraq. But, you know, the fact that he's made this claim and that it's his only claim left as far as the legitimacy of this war goes, I think actually gives us tremendous leverage to say, you know, this was a disaster. It was a murderous disaster. Let's try to make something good come out of it, which would be a real democracy in Iraq that is not shackled, handcuffed, either by Saddam Hussein's debts and bad contracts or the laws written by the Coalition Provisional Authority or, pre-sold to Halliburton and Bechtel. I think that's an amazing positive. That would be an amazing positive victory.
And then finally, the last time you were on the show, you said that the global justice movement, or whatever it is we call it, is sort of in a state of arrested political development because of the lack of any kind of strategy towards the state or any kind of agenda.
Did I say that, or did you?
No, you actually did. So I was wondering if you had any further thoughts along that, organizing around this occupation might be relevant to that. But
I think it is. I think it is because it is. It is an opportunity to engage to put forward a positive program, one that is in direct solidarity with people's movements that are emerging in Iraq. I agree with Arundhati that we need a win as opposed to just sort of feeling good because we can go to big demonstrations with people who agree with us. But I also think that there, you know, I also said on the show, I remember, that we do have to really separate when we talk about whatever this movement is, whether we're talking about the U.S., whether we're talking about North America, whether we're talking about Europe, whether we're talking about Latin America, because I do think that certainly in Latin America, the past year has been, there's been a seismic political shift, and I would say that the general population is engaged in quite sophisticated policy discussions and is engaging with the state. Social movements are engaging with the state, some successfully, some not. We're kept in a state of arrested development to some extent by our own arrested political cultures, particularly in the U.S. I have to say I found it really amazing, you know, being outside the U.S. a little bit in Canada, just watching all of this backlash against Dean's anger. I mean, I'm not a huge Dean fan or anything, but I do firmly believe that Americans need to get very, very, very angry, and that any leader that helps people get angry at this moment in history, really, really is doing good work. So the idea that being angry is somehow a crime right now shows, I guess, that we have a long way to go.
It's only acceptable to be angry at the poor and the weak in America.
Yeah.